Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In February, President Trump said that the U.S. murder rate is the highest in 45 years. That's incorrect. 22 years ago, the rate was 8.2 deaths per 100,000 people. By 2015, that had dropped to 5 per capita. But in some cities, including the well-known Chicago and lesser-noticed Columbus, that's not the case. The Wall Street Journal in December reported that 16 of the 20 largest police departments reported an increase from the previous year. Chicago is a dramatic example, up 56%. Columbus ranks 14th in U.S. in the United States in population, but its homicide rate was 7th highest last year, when 12 people were killed for every 100,000 residents. We're talking about the history of murder rates, what they mean from year to year. Joining us by phone is the executive director of the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association, Daryl Stevens. Welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you today.
And with me in the studio, Ohio State University professor of history and sociology and the co-founder and co-director of the Historical Violence Database, Randolph Roth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ann.
So what does tracking homicide rates tell us over time? Maybe we begin with what we're talking about when we say a homicide rate.
Well, it's a tough sort of thing when you look at, it's an abstract thing, trying to figure out how many out of every 100,000 people will be murdered in a given year. And that really varies quite a bit over time. But, you know, when we look at, when we say for two-thirds of the 20th century, we had, say, a rate of 10 per 100,000. And we think of that as being very, it sounds low, even though it's by far the highest of any affluent society in the world. We are the most violent affluent society. But what you have to figure about the cost of that is you're exposed to that rate every year of your life. So your chance of being murdered isn't that. It's really 76, 77 times that. Which means that really, at those rates we were running in most of the 20th century, it meant that one out of every 140 children born in a country would be murdered. So these are what can sound like a small rate is actually very high when you multiply it by life expectancy. And that's why we feel, even at 5 per 100,000, we feel threatened, because actually that's a high rate of people who are going to end up being murdered over the course of their lives.
Okay, 5 per 100,000 year after year after year, 10 per 100 or whatever it is.
Yeah, so that costs a lot. Now, you know, we aren't at the most violent. We were far more violent in the 1960s and 70s, far more violent between World War I and the New Deal, really between 1934. But the worst period we've really had is the Civil War era, just horrifying levels of violence.
And you're not talking about the war in and of itself, though.
No, we're talking about this is outside of the war. Absolutely. In fact, the murder rate starts to go up when the Mexican War starts. And what you'll see is whenever you have political instability, whenever you have a loss of fellow feeling in the society, whenever you lose faith in that government, its legitimacy, you'll see these rates soar. So if you ask, for instance, if you look at the best correlate over long periods of time of the homicide rate in the United States, the best correlate I've found, oddly enough, is the percentage of new counties in any decade we named after national heroes up until from colonial times through to the 1920s, when we don't have too many new counties. And essentially what it is when we identify in unconscious ways with our national heroes, whether we're part of Britain or part of America, we don't kill each other. When we don't have that strong sense of kinship with people who we don't know, we tend to kill. When hate speech, for instance, if you track out the use of the N-word in the 19th century in publications, it tracks out the murder rate perfectly. And it's frightening among unrelated adults. So this kind of political instability, the kind of hatred against the slave owners, against former slaves and African Americans, it plays out into a kind of anger and frustration and builds those hostile, defensive, predatory emotions that lead to an increase in murder rates among unrelated adults. Child murders follow a different pattern. Intimate partner violence follows a different pattern. But the big thing we're talking about today is really about those homicides among unrelated adults. That's where we stand out. And so the 1960s and 70s, when we have our government lose its legitimacy, when you see the hate speech and the anger, when we see us moving towards political instability and a great deal of violent riots, etc., you'll see the everyday homicide rate will go up. And then as that passes away, you'll see it go down. So that's the kind of thing that we see when we look really long periods of time. A revolution is another period when we peaked. And again, it's not just the political violence that peaks. It's this every day. It's bar fights. It's honor killings. It's a property dispute with your neighbor. All these things that we think aren't connected to those bigger feelings. But somehow, you know, if we feel our government has our back, if we feel included, if we feel empowered, even if the government doesn't do what we want, you know, we can go around our daily business with confidence. And what's striking is that when we don't feel that way, every little insult, every little slight, every little frustration can trigger something. So this is what we're really thinking in terms of feelings and beliefs. They're hard to measure. That's the tough part of it. But we do see that those are the big, deep patterns in human behavior.
Daryl Stevens, you know, Professor Roth just kind of gave us that more sweeping, long-term what we know about correlations in society and homicide rates. You know, the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association needs to get a little bit more granular because they deal with it on a day-to-day basis. What do you make of it as an institution, this, you know, the overall arc of violence in the United States?
Well, we have certainly haven't gone back to the Revolutionary War like the professor has, but I've been involved in policing now for close to 50 years and was a police officer on the streets in the 60s and 70s and a police chief through the 80s and 90s and the first part of the 2000s. And so I've watched the ebb and flow of homicides take place in our larger cities for quite some time and participated in trying to develop solutions in response to it. And the professor's comments are interesting in terms of how people feel confident in the legitimacy of government and that type of thing. But what one thing is that homicides in urban America are concentrated. They're concentrated in our high poverty areas, and that may be where the greatest question of legitimacy of the police or government in general may be the highest. But even though we've seen dramatic declines since the 90s, which were the peaks in homicide rates in the United States, down to what they are today, even though we've seen increases, it's still significantly lower than the 90s. That's largely concentrated in our high poverty minority neighborhoods of America's big cities. Mm-hmm. And so our focus on trying to respond to that and trying to deal with the issues that we see in that is concentrated there.
And has that always been the case, Daryl?
It's been the case as long as I've been involved in policing. The numbers may vary significantly from, you know, one, or may vary from one time frame to another, but my entire time in policing and working in several urban cities and for what I've watched from homicides, they have always been concentrated in those neighborhoods. If you look at Chicago or St. Louis or Baltimore, you'll find the same kinds of concentrations of violence.
And even in like a New York, Austin, San Diego, which had the lowest homicide rates and are also very, very large cities, Daryl Stevens?
Yes, same for definitely in New York. I don't know for sure about Austin or San Diego, but I would be very surprised if it was different than what we see in other large cities around the country.
So Randolph Roth, I mean, does that make sense in the context of your point of view on this, that larger sweep?
I couldn't agree more.
Even
with,
in the colonial days, it was going to be in the urban, the poorer places.
I couldn't agree more with Daryl. When we're looking at really what's been happening since really the 50s, it's really concentrated poverty in our urban areas and in our rural areas. And a lot of the great work that's been done on this really supports that. You know, where we find that when you account for concentrated poverty, racial differences, for instance, in homicide rates virtually disappear. And it's really living entirely in a neighborhood surrounded by people who are as abjectly poor as you. It doesn't take actually many middle-class people to leaven a neighborhood and to change its trajectory as far as murder is concerned. So this is a real problem. What I would say, you know, historically, and this is going way back, you know, certainly as the homicide rate drops, it becomes more concentrated in these areas, I think. You'll see more broadcasting out, where my students and I are just working on this, looking at the non-urban neighborhoods in the 1960s and 70s around Cleveland, Cincinnati, Columbus. And it's stunning to see how that violence, when it really peaks up the way you are in the 60s and 70s, diffuses out into neighborhoods and into areas you wouldn't suspect. But when you drop that, but it's really still absolutely in the 60s, it's heavily concentrated and with concentrated poverty. And when it shrinks back and the homicide rate goes down, you can get the impression that it's entirely about that. And really, that's what we have to focus on now. But there's that cross-sectional constant. And again, it's consistent with what I'm talking about with the ups and downs, because certainly, so I agree with him entirely in that.
Darrell Stevens, what is considered violent crime these days?
Well, generally, it's the classification from the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Uniform Crime Reports, and they will put four different offenses together, and that's what they normally call violent crime: homicide, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault, which is assaults that could possibly lead to death or serious bodily harm, like somebody shooting at you or shooting and hitting you but not dying. That would be an aggravated assault.
And has that been data, Professor Roth, that you've kept, that we have had access to over time?
Well,
are you comparing apples to apples when you go back to the colonial days versus, you know, in the Civil War time? And
well, the terrible thing about it is we rely so much on official sources, and as I'm sure Darrell knows, not everybody does the reporting, not everybody turns it in, and so oddly enough, what we have reconstructed from multiple sources for the colonial period is actually more comprehensive and accurate than what we know about the present. Unless we go back in and fix those numbers. You really need to look at all of the data exists. Police departments have kept it carefully. Medical examiners have it. Newspapers have it. But you have to put all those sources together, and people just don't send them in. There's no, for instance, the FBI, when they started these systems, like the supplementary homicide reports, they did not provide any of the police department's funds to fill out those long forms, and there's no penalty for not returning them. So that's why, you know, if you look at the non-urban police counties in Ohio in the 60s and 70s, fewer than 60% of the homicides are getting turned into the FBI. So when we look at this data, we've had data for a long time. Health department data we've had pretty accurate since the 1920s. But again, you know, there's gaps. And what we do as historians is we try to reconstruct it from multiple sources, and we come up with much higher numbers. Yeah,
Darrell Stevens, as an organization, Major Cities Police Chiefs Association, are your members interested in each other's situations, each other's circumstances? Do you want to know what's happening in other cities? Are you interested in that larger thing? Or does it not really relate? In other words, the fact that the rates haven't changed or they've gone down in San Diego, Austin, and New York City, it's not really relevant to maybe what's happening in Columbus or Chicago.
It is relevant. And actually, a year and a half ago, we began collecting violent crime on those four violent crimes that I mentioned a while ago and non-fatal shootings. We began collecting the data on a quarterly basis. The FBI reports are just simply not available to you. In fact, just the 2015 report was just released in late August, early part of September of this year. So the data is way, way behind. And so the large city chiefs are interested. They're tracking. They know what happens in their own community, but they want to see if what's happening in their community is very different from what's happening in other places across the country. And while people are always cautioned about about comparing this data, it's always done. They want to see how how Columbus compares to Chicago or to New York or Kansas City or St. Louis, just kind of as a benchmark. In and chiefs are no different. But the conversation also goes into what people attribute the change to, either up or down, and so that's the opportunity. And we meet three times a year, and part of our conversations here always include what's happening with the crime rates in the large cities, is what people are learning from their own city, how that matches with what happens in their communities, and looking for ways that they can be more effective in responding to the changes that are taking place.
We are talking about homicide rates in the United States across the board. They've been going down. Some cities, though, such as Chicago and Columbus, St. Louis, and several others, have trended up in recent years. We're talking today about why that is and what you need to know. My guests, you just heard from Daryl Stevens. He's the executive director of the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association. That's a national professional association representing the nation's 63 largest police forces. Also with us, Randolph Rolfe, history and sociology professor at OSU and co-founder and co-director of the Historical Violence Database. I just want to let you know that we did invite a representative of the Columbus Division of Police to join us for any part of this conversation, and they declined the invitation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about homicide rates and what drives them higher in some big cities while the nationwide rate declines. While Columbus ranks just 14th in the U.S. in population, its homicide rate was the seventh highest last year, when 12 people were killed for every 100,000 residents. We invited a representative of the Columbus Division of Police to join us for any part of the conversation, and they declined our invitation. Still with us by phone is the executive director of the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association, Daryl Stevens. Once again, Daryl, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you again.
Also with us, Ohio State University professor of history and sociology and co-founder and co-director of the Historical Violence Database, Randolph Rolfe. Welcome again.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Ames Grauert. He's from the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice and co-author of Crime in 2016, Updated Analysis. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me today.
After taking the oath of office in February, Attorney General Jeff Sessions said that the increases in violent crime are not an aberration, that they are part of a permanent trend. Ames Grauer, what did your analysis turn up on that topic?
So one thing we've looked at, especially recently, is not just focusing on how crime rates have changed in the past 2 years, but trying to put them in a broader historical context. So we're going to be releasing a broader analysis that goes into detail on how crime rates have changed 1990 to 2016 in the next couple of weeks. But we've done that. We have that data already. And what it shows is that if you look at where crime rates are today, they're still substantially lower than they were in 1990, 1991, down almost 50%. So what I worry about when hearing Attorney General Sessions or the president talk about crime rate increases becoming a permanent trend or being, quote, out of control, I worry that they're not putting it in the appropriate historical context and stoking fears without any real basis.
And by stoking fears, does that go to the sense that you were getting at, Randolph Rolfe, that people feel insecure? They feel that does that go any toward what you were saying about that kind of alienation?
Well, it's a tough sort of a thing. When we looked at, again, we're still just getting the data right now, but I am concerned about, as Adam is, about what's been happening, in 2015, 2016. We have seen a statistically significant increase in the cities. When I looked at what was happening in 2008, 2009, when President Obama was a candidate, I predicted online, one of our news network news sites, that I thought if he won the election, that the homicide rate would drop substantially right after the election, particularly in American cities, because of what that would say to young, not only young minority people, but to all Americans. And I was concerned what would happen in the areas of the country that I thought would have the most trouble with a black president, which would be the Upper South. And as you watch that, watch his candidacy catch hold, what you see is that the homicide rates did drop significantly right on through in the major cities in those first 6 months after he was elected, and you see it go up in the Upper South. Now, what we're going to be seeing now towards the end of the Obama presidency and the frustration over the police shootings, you know, we're looking at, you know, Rick Rosenfeld, who was the chair of our National Academy of Sciences Roundtable on Crime Trends, really starting to think that it is a question of legitimacy and about what the spinoff effect of this is, what effect this is going to have on murder rates. They might scissor. I don't think, though, I agree, we're not going to go back to where we were in the 90s. I don't think so. But these are smaller effects, and they're hard to tease out.
You know, we have an email from George, and I want to throw it out to the group of you, starting with you, Ames Grawart. This is from George. He says, national homicide rates are down because survivor rates are up. Victims of crime are now surviving when in past years they would have become a homicide statistic. This is due to more effective communications, which cut the response time for emergency services. These improved emergency services now provide immediate medical treatment, which in past years was available only in hospitals. Ames Grawart, you know, accounts for a higher survival rate in war as well.
That's interesting. I've actually, I wouldn't be surprised if that's partially to explain. We've actually done some research, and it's very preliminary, so I just want to throw out the idea to you all, looking at that from the opposite end, that the increase in homicides in some major cities, which are real, which don't necessarily signify a national crime wave or reversal of long-term trends, but they're worth looking at. We're looking at data that might suggest that it's due to increased firearm lethality. Like there's the same number of shootings happening, but an increased number of deaths. There's some data that's been done on that in Baltimore, and it's at least worth looking at further. I think it could very well be that medical care has caught up and has helped more victims of crime survive, but we might be seeing some pushback on that as a more for lack of a better term, effective firearms make it to the street.
So when you're saying same number of shootings, increasing number of deaths, that means the mass shooting issue.
It would mean that the types of guns that are being used in crimes are more lethal today than they have been before. And it's just a theory still, but it's worth worth looking at.
Daryl Stevens, does that resonate with you?
It does indeed. There, many of the chiefs that have experienced these dramatic increases in homicides over the past couple of years, and even those six or eight cities that really kind of stand apart from the rest of the large cities, all talk about the availability of guns and availability of high-powered guns with high-capacity magazines. They're seeing a lot more rounds fired at these shootings that take place on the street, recovering a lot more shell casings, and generally more bullets are flying when the shooting starts. But medical care has made an enormous difference in the homicide rate as well.
Yeah. Randolph Roth?
You know what? The latest work on that is pulling back a little bit at the impact of medical care not being quite as dramatic as they thought. It's still there, I agree, but it's not to the extent that the early flawed studies suggested. The real big gain in terms of saving lives with modern medical care actually happened between 1850 and 1960, and no one really thinks about that. You go back to before the Civil War, you know, we think the homicide rate would be half of what it was with modern medical care. But I agree with Daryl that, I mean, even the muzzle velocity of these firearms is going up.
What's the difference? Oh, the speed with which
the bullets.
The speed,
and that has to do with the momentum. So you've got these rounds. They're carrying a lot more energy than they used to. I mean, so all of these things are really making these firearms far more dangerous. But yeah, the multiple rounds is one of the big issues. The high capacity magazines, yeah.
Robert in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hey, and so I've got a question that I just want to throw this out to the panel. Mm-hmm. What would be their take on media affecting homicide rates? Because I honestly think that part of the problem with the homicide rate is the glorification of using a gun to solve the problem, and especially when it comes to minorities and gangs.
And when you say media, are you talking about television and film drama type thing?
Well, I'm mainly more talking about music, emphasizing the use using a firearm to solve a problem. I have a beef with this person, so I'm just going to
blow him up. Yeah, okay. Well, I'm glad he clarified that. That's a big difference. Ames Grauwert, any correlations there that you can speak of?
Sure. One thing, so when we put out a report late last year, looking at what was driving murder increases in some big cities, the one story we hit on is Chicago, as you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we found could be causing an increase in murders in Chicago was proliferation of gangs. What we've heard from Chicago police officers is that an increasing number of the people that are both victims and perpetrators of homicides in the city are people that they sort of already knew about, that were already on a heat list they had of suspected gang members, or at least it overlaps with suspected gang members. So I think there's some reason to fear that gangs might be tied to some of the violence increasing in Chicago. I want to add one thing to the other media effect on mm-hmm. crime, which you were hitting on earlier. There's some research that shows that people's perceptions of crime in the country as a whole diverge from their perceptions of crime in their neighborhood. So if you ask someone on the street, like, how is crime trending in your neighborhood, they'll say, oh, it's safer than it's ever been. And then if you say, what's crime looking like in the country as a whole, they'll say, oh, it's absolutely out of control. So that suggests to me that people might be influenced into thinking crime rates are changing more than they are by, looking at the morning news, evening news, which tends to highlight, the tragedies of the day.
It's kind of like how we consider our Congress members. Daryl Stevens, when you're talking like incrementally, there's a murder today or a homicide today, maybe two homicides tomorrow, that kind of a thing. It seems worse than it is. But I know the politician in all of us wants to say, but every life matters. How do your members in the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association grapple with how to handle the emotional impact of day after day?
Well, they work very hard. I mean, every life does really matter. And so police chiefs and detectives that investigate these cases and police officers that respond to them work very hard at trying to solve them. Even though clearance rates have declined in recent years and there's some challenges in cities and the mention of gangs, which is a factor that you hear police chiefs talk about as a contributing factor to the change that we've seen in the past couple of years in large cities, don't produce the same kinds of willingness of people to come forward to share the knowledge that they have with the police and to testify. They're afraid. And the police work through these and as effective as the best way they can, and that even goes to the importance of establishing strong, positive relationships with people in the community. Good relationships, the better the relationships, the more, the greater the legitimacy of the police and the greater willingness to participate in trying to solve these problems. On the media point, one mm-hmm. of the things that we've seen, not the news media so much as the social media. That's become a place where we see gangs insulting each other, individuals insulting each other or challenging each other. And we've seen in a number of our cities, the police chiefs will talk about homicides that take place as a result of being disrespected or insulted on social media, and the response is violence. And so you have this tit-for-tat type of thing, and one of the things that the police work on is, you know, by understanding the gangs and those connections within their community, when you have one of these homicides, they work very hard to try to intervene in a way that keeps the retaliation from taking place.
And when you talk about the disrespecting on social media thing, is that related to what I see referred to as honor killings, that kind of a thing?
I'm not exactly sure what was meant by honor killings, but I think it's it means the same thing.
Randolph Roth, is that what you were referring to, I guess?
Oh,
maybe
yeah,
it was you
yeah.
earlier.
About reputation.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely about reputation, and we see that, and it's a constant. You know, whenever the murder rate goes up, you see more of those. I was just going to say, I mean, just in response to the caller's question, mm-hmm. You'd be amazed to see what just having newspapers in the 19th century did. People were copycatting. People were seeing, I'm going to do that, what so-and-so did to so-and-so. You can see it even with ballads about murders in the 17th century. So any kind of media that gets out there in the culture can have a traumatic effect. And it can also represent a cultural change. When we look at the surge in youth homicides, went suddenly up in the mid-80s, went suddenly down in the 1990s. It correlates perfectly with the sales of Oakland Raiders paraphernalia. It correlates perfectly with the rise and fall of gangster rap. The first real gangster rap song was 1985. And you can chart it with sales of NWA albums up and down as young people embraced that angry, alienated lifestyle and then rejected it. Certainly we're looking at more, you know, certainly gang culture, et cetera, is still out there. That hostility towards law enforcement is still out there, but it's not what it was in that peak period there.
Which makes Chicago such an interesting study.
Yeah, they've had real bad. I mean, at least Daryl will be able to speak to this better than I do. It's just what I've heard from my friends in law enforcement. They'll say, well, you know, Columbus. What I've heard say, Columbus police say we have wannabe gangs. Chicago has the real thing.
The real deal. And Ames
and Detroit does, too. And you can see it. You look at our murders in the 1980s when I'm studying this. Our tough guys in Cleveland and Canton and such were terrified of what they called the Detroit boys. Detroit boys had a system and a culture and a business and everything that was just brutal. And so not every city is facing the same cultural phenomena, the same organizational phenomena. But Daryl knows that much better than I do, so I better be quiet and let him speak.
we'll continue our conversation. We're talking about homicides in the United States, why they're going up in some places and are continuing the downward trend of many years in others. You just heard from Randolph Roth. He is a history and sociology professor at OSU and co-founder and co-director of the Historical Violence Database. And also with us, Ames Grauwert. He's counsel in the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School and co-author of Crime in 2016 Updated Analysis. Also, Daryl Stevens, executive director of the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about homicide rates and what drives them higher in some big cities while the nationwide rate declines. While Columbus ranks just 14th in the U.S. in population, its homicide rate was the seventh highest last year when 12 people were killed for every 100,000 residents. We invited a representative of the Columbus Department of Public Safety to join us for any part of the conversation. They declined the invitation. Still with us by phone is the executive director of the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association, Daryl Stevens. And Daryl, thanks again for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Also, Ames Grauert, he's from the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice and co-author of Crime in 2016, Updated Analysis. Again, Ames, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
And with me in the studio, OSU professor of history and sociology and co-founder and co-director of the Historical Violence Database, Randolph Roth. And Randolph Roth, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Ames, you co-authored, as I said, the Crime in 2016 Annual Analysis. Can you give us a thumbnail of how it compares, say, to the last 2 years or the last 10 years?
Sure. So we've been doing these studies for the last 2 years. We did one in 2015 and one in 2016. I can give you some highlights in 2014 as well. Mm-hmm. 2014 was sort of the low watermark for murder rates in the United States. The national murder rate hit a low point that I don't think had been achieved since the 1960s. 2015 and 2016 both saw some increases in murder rates, especially in the 30 largest cities. The interesting thing that we found, though, is that this was true in both 2015 and 2016. Those increases were highly concentrated when you looked at cities. So it wasn't like every city across the board was seeing, say, 9 to 10 to 20% increase in murder mm-hmm. rates. It was more like a few cities were really driving it. So in 2015, it was Baltimore, Chicago, and D.C. Together, those represented over half of the increase in murders in the cities we studied. Last year, Chicago itself, no other city, just Chicago, represented around 43% of the increase.
The nationwide increase.
Oh, I'm sorry. In the group of 30 cities we studied.
Gotcha.
That distortion, I'm sure, would be represented in the national data. We just don't have it from the FBI yet for 2016.
And we were talking a little bit about gangs. Daryl Stevens, there's the wannabe gangs that Randolph Roth mentioned earlier, and then there's the real deal. How much do you think, you know, from what you hear from your members in the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association, that plays a role here?
Well, it certainly is a key issue in Chicago. Los Angeles, even though their homicides declined a little bit this past year versus 2015, and Los Angeles County, both of those jurisdictions talk about gangs and the continuing impact of gangs and violence. Philadelphia talks about that as well when they talk about changes that they've seen in homicide rates. So it's a significant factor in a good number of the urban areas. There is certainly a difference from the between the wannabe groups and the long-term established places like Chicago and Detroit. But even the wannabes are a part of the violence. They react to the insults. They engage in the activities that they engage in, and a substantial part of that leads to violence of one sort or another.
And Ames Grauer, what as far as the gang influence, we were talking earlier about how over the long stretches of time, stretches of history, as you know, Randolph Roth has studied the history of violence. There's an uptick during times of discontent, times of alienation, and lack of faith in government and governmental entities. Does that hold true? Do you know if there's any insights about whether or not that's the case in terms of recruitment for gangs and that kind of a thing? Is there any correlation there with that?
You know, that's something we've tried to look at. I guess it's no surprise that it's a difficult phenomenon to study.
They don't keep membership records, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. This is something that I'm sure the other people on the call will also have some ideas about, too. But in the past few years, a couple people have talked about whether there might be a crisis of trust with communities not trusting law enforcement to keep them safe, and whether that might be
jeopardizing the relationship between communities and police, and that might in turn contribute to increasing murder rates. That's a really tough thing to study, but it's also a really important one. Mm-hmm. I know the one thing that we've found is in research we did to try to analyze what caused the crime decline between 1990 and 2015, we found that more officers on the streets and more officers using data-driven policing techniques like CompStat definitely contributed to decreasing crime rates. So I think there's some merit to the idea that more policing and good policing can help drive crime down. And if we're seeing police ranks decline and clearance rates fall, as I think someone else mentioned, that could be contributing to violence sort of filling the power vacuum.
So, Randolph Roth, let's talk about the police role in this. What does your data tell you about, because when police shoot somebody and they die, that's should be included in these homicide statistics, right? It is death.
And virtually all of these are very much justified homicides. I mean, the kinds of situations as we look at these, the police officers find themselves in are terrifying. I mean, what's impressive is how often tremendous restraint is shown and things don't lead to homicide or violence. So I think, certainly when we look at these things, but highly publicized cases,
which is more and more the case nowadays,
which is the situation, is a problem. Yeah. And again, it's very difficult. People are angry and they say this was unjustified and there's no justice here. The thing is it seems to me, I just don't know of police officers who go to work thinking that they want to commit premeditated murder today, but they get charged with it. And so it's a tough kind of issue.
So as those overall rates have declined, though, in homicides, is that true? Is there a way to suss out police shootings to show that
we don't have good data? But the one thing that I have the law enforcement data for the state of California from 1987 to 2012, and it has startled me. Yeah. Because what you see, and this is troubling, and I don't know the particulars, and so I don't really want to say this in an inflammatory way, but you'll see that, as Ames said, the general homicide rate has gone down. We see that justified killings by civilians have gone down. In other words, a burglar breaks in, I'm in danger, I kill that person. Mm-hmm. That has gone down. We see homicides of police officers has gone down since
killings
that period.
Killings of police officers. Okay.
What hasn't dropped in California is the rate at which officers are killing civilians. And I think you could see how it's starting to stand out. And there is concern, I know, from folks who I know in Cincinnati and Columbus about the number of shootings that have happened in the last 4 or 5 years. There have been, on the one hand, they'll say there's too many. The other hand, they find that they're all justified. In other words, there's reason, officer had reason to believe that themselves or others were in danger. But the question is, where could you have de-escalated that? What was the strategy the officer took? But what we see is that those aren't going down. And I must say, historically, that's a surprise, because what you'll see historically is murders of law enforcement officers and homicides by law enforcement officers going up and down with the murder rate with unrelated adults. They just go up and down. And this is the first time I've seen a set of data, and that's statistically significant for California. It's a big state.
It's big.
It's been flat. It hasn't gone up, but it's been flat.
Daryl Stevens, is this something you're talking about with your membership in the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association?
Absolutely. It's been a huge focus of the police, particularly over the past 3 or 4 years. Ferguson was kind of a benchmark for a lot of agencies, a lot of urban agencies, and the backlash around officer-involved shootings has caused police to focus on this quite heavily. I'm surprised to hear about the data in California, to be honest with you. The data is sketchy from a national perspective,
Absolutely.
But from experience, it just has felt to me like the, not so much the death, but it's felt to me like the number of shootings by police officers have declined over the years. And so, hopefully the data collection efforts that have been initiated, the FBI is in a process of testing a process as we speak. Hopefully that will allow us to understand these encounters and be able to respond to them more effectively. But it is an important issue for the police. They've worked on de-escalation. They've worked on improving training. They've worked on situational encounters to minimize the use of deadly force. But it's a continuing challenge for us.
Yeah, I just wanted to just say, if I may, Ann, that I agree with Darryl Boy. It really, there are a lot less of these fewer shootings than there were in the 60s and
70s. They're just more publicized now.
Yeah, the 60s and 70s, although they, when you go back and look at the media in the 60s and 70s as a historian, boy, they were publicized and they were controversial.
But what I mean is social media has changed the dynamic a great deal, like
absolutely.
You brought up earlier.
Absolutely.
Ames Grauer, one thing we have not raised, we've talked probably, it's ancillary to the whole gang issue, but is drugs and the opioid heroin and synthetic opioid epidemic. Can you talk about that a little bit and how that's, is this just in the last few years where that's become an issue, or maybe it's not? I don't know.
I think it's hugely significant. There seems to have been a growing consensus over the last year or so that the increased use of opioids is something we all should really be paying attention to. And I think it's finally sort of broken to the surface. So I'm glad to hear it talked about here too. I think that we've seen this in some rural counties, for example. We talk about murder rates in big cities, but in the 2015 FBI data, there was also a hint that some of the smallest counties were seeing an increase in crime rates, too, and seeing an increase in rates of incarceration. If so, that could be traced to an opioid epidemic, and that's something that could have far-ranging consequences for all of us who care about, better policing, better criminal justice system.
And Darryl Stevens, do you agree? I mean, is that sort of part and parcel of what you're grappling with at the local level?
It is indeed. You don't hear a police chief talking about not just increases in violence, but violence in their communities over the past two or three years that didn't raise the issue of the opioid epidemic, the number of deaths that to overdoses, and it's also contributing to destabilizing the markets that exist and which leads to violence.
And the gang connection there as well, Randolph Roth, is significant. It matters. I mean, it's largely pacifist, the group coming out of Mexico that we've talked about many times on this show, but it's
That's
changing
right.
too.
That's, well, I just know that I wish our friends from the Columbus PD were here because, essentially, yes, the Nayarites, those drug dealers really tried to stay away from firearms violations so they wouldn't have to do the same time. They had this sort of marketing strategy, which we all know very well, which tended to avoid violence. But the fact is what's happened in Columbus just the last year is MS-13 has been moving in, and they're worried that there's going to be an effort by them to push out.
That's an El Salvadoran.
I think so, yeah. That they're gonna push out our less violent drug dealers. The word is that I've heard they've already committed several murders just in the past year here, trying to take turf away from the people who had been marketing heroin here for years. We know that Columbus is the epicenter of the upper Midwest for distribution of heroin. And so that's very worrisome if that violent group comes in and takes over.
Randolph Roth, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time as always.
Thank you.
It's Randolph Roth. He's history and sociology professor at Ohio State and co-founder and co-director of the Historical Violence Database. Also, Darryl Stevens, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
Darryl Stevens, executive director of the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association. And Ames Grauer, thanks as well. I appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Ames Grauer, counsel in the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School and co-author of the Crime in 2016 Updated Analysis. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.